Our last case of January 96-3406 CR State v. Agnello. We have Mr. Is it Buting or Budding? Buting, representing the defendant, Mr. Agnello. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jerome Buting from the law firm of Buting & Williams, and I'm here representing the defendant appellant, Lucien Agnello, today. This case presents a number of issues which really all revolve around one primary issue, which is the admissibility of a defendant's confession on the grounds that it was involuntarily obtained through the use of police coercion. Mr. Agnello was arrested and subsequently charged with the murder of his adoptive stepfather. Following a lengthy period of interrogation, he signed a written statement admitting to a number of things. His counsel filed a written motion pretrial requesting a Miranda Goodchild hearing, which was subsequently heard by the trial court. The Miranda issues that were raised at trial were not challenged on appeal and therefore are not before this court. Voluntariness issues raised, however, were challenged on appeal. Unfortunately, the Court of Appeals applied a very broad and I believe erroneous waiver standard and never addressed some of the key issues that I believe are before this court now.
Let me ask you, counsel, on that. It seems to me that there's some basic rudimentary things that defense counsel should do when you're making, if that's the key to your motion, and what the, if I read the Court of Appeals decision, the reason waiver has some impact is that you never, you being the representatives of the defendant, never at one time that brought up either the Rogers case or the Deno case. I mean, you didn't alert the court to it. Are you saying that this is not an obligation and it's just something that should be taken for granted that the courts would know and apply that law the minute some scintilla of significance came in about what we're talking about, voluntariness of this confession, and whether there was coercion? That seems to be your position, isn't it?
In part.
And I was going to ask, why do you think that this would be different than other cases where you have to have some specificity?
Well, first of all, I think the record indicates that the trial judge did know what the basis of the objection was, that the not relevant objection, this isn't relevant for the purposes of this hearing, actually alerted the trial court, and the trial court did know that what he was referring to was the Rogers rule. The reason I think that is because the court didn't just overrule the objection, say overruled and leave it at that. She said overruled, or she said that this goes to the credibility of the witness, answer the question. Now, admittedly, that's on both sides. Counsel's objection, which was more than just a general objection, by the way. It wasn't simply objection overruled. It was objection with grounds cited. And that distinguishes it from a lot of the other cases that the state cites and that normally require the rule that set forth some specificity in the objection. But admittedly, objection, this isn't relevant, this goes to credibility, answer the question, is a rather truncated exchange between the parties, but it's a typically truncated form that a busy urban court that deals with these issues regularly, in fact, sometimes several times a week when they have these hearings, that's simply the way the process moves forward because of their busy caseload. Indeed, in Milwaukee, local rules of decorum prevent counsel from arguing further the grounds for an objection, particularly when not only the court has ruled by overruling your objection, but has also given her own grounds, or the court's own grounds for that, which is this goes to credibility.
You're saying that you were prevented from further exploring that because of the local rules of the Milwaukee court system.
That would be one of my arguments, yes, that counsel, I think, Everybody knew what was going on. That was the issue that was being raised, and that's why it was truncated on both sides as much as it was.
Mr. Buting, let's jump from the waiver issue and assume that for a minute, for purposes of argument, that you're right, that the court really was alerted to the issue here. What's wrong with the approach that Judge Fine took in his concurring opinion? I understand his reasoning is a little bit like this, that consistent with Jackson versus Dennell and Rogers versus Richmond, you can't use the information or question about the truthfulness of the confession and then use it on whether or not that confession was voluntary, but you can use it on why the defendant confessed. In other words, the remorsefulness. What's wrong with that? That's a pretty interesting distinction, I think.
It is, but there's a number of problems with that. The first of which, perhaps the most glaring, is that it creates a loophole that would effectively nullify the Rogers rule in every case. Because in every case, the state could argue, well, he didn't confess because he was coerced, he confessed because he felt guilty and had the urge to confess, as Judge Fine talks in his book.
Well, but the facts in this particular case are a little bit different than maybe a lot of other cases, in that it's my understanding that the testimony of the officers was that as the defendant was confessing, as he was giving his statement, that he was crying, that he was showing remorse during the course of the questioning every time the issue of his foster father and his death came up. So doesn't that change it a little bit? Doesn't that take it out of the every case scenario?
It doesn't, in my opinion, for this reason, because while it may be true that this defendant or that many defendants may have remorse if they are guilty and a guilty conscience and may, part of them may want to purge themselves of their wrongdoing, the real focus under voluntariness is whether the police practices were coercive such that they presented the standard in Clappus is a conspicuously unequal confrontation in which pressures were brought to bear to overcome the defendant's ability to resist. So in other words, even if someone has that in them, and if the police coerce them and present them with these kinds of pressures to make that come out, that's what's coercive. And that's what the focus of voluntariness goes to, not whether or not somebody subjectively has the urge to confess because of remorse. But in addition, there's another very important aspect, and that is Rogers, and I believe Jackson as well, both warn about the problem, the primary problem that they have with allowing a fact finder, judge, in this circumstance, to consider evidence, or to even hear evidence and consider evidence of truthfulness or falseness of the confession, in that it taints the fact finder judge's ability to reliably determine whether the confession was coerced.
Well, doesn't that tie into yet another argument, another alternative that the state presents? The idea being that Judge Sykes, in this case, never used that information, that when she gave her decision on voluntariness, that she never referred at all to whether the confession was or was not truthful.
Well, my answer to that is that she did, as I'll explain in a second, but also what Rogers says is that when that is brought into the hearing, it's impossible to measure the ways in which it does taint the fact finder, including the fact finder's determination of historical fact. And in this case, what that really means in these hearings is the judge's determination of credibility issues. And here, that's what Judge Sykes did do. She, in fact, in her hearing talked about, in her ruling talked about how she viewed the defendant as not credible, primarily because of his evasive answers and his, quote, selective memory. Well, if you look at the transcript of his testimony, the only time when he had a, quote, selective memory and seemed evasive were in response to those improper questions going to the truthfulness or falsity of his confession. Did you plan to kill this man with a co-defendant? I don't remember, or possibly. The whole sequence of questions that followed that were in violation of Rogers are the only ones where he had a selective memory, and that's what the court is clearly, I think, referring to when she says that.
Well, suppose the court agreed with the concurrence that you could ask questions to show that remorse, guilty conscience, caused the person to write out or sign this confession. What kind of questions do you think that counsel could ask? I mean, if that were the standard.
If that were the standard?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think through. I suppose you could say, do you have a guilty conscience? Would that have caused you to confess?
I suppose you could ask the direct question of, isn't it true, Mr. Agnello, that the real reason you confessed was not because of you were tired or anything else, but because you felt guilty and remorseful about this? I mean, that's one example of a direct question that might be asked, but I'd point out that neither the prosecutor or the trial court ever referred to that as a reason to allow these questions.
But that's not in there. But I mean, I'm trying to think through it. If the court adopts a standard, what kind of questions would be okay? What kind of questions could you ask that would indicate that the reason for the confession is remorse, a willingness to get this terrible burden off your chest?
Well, I mean, I guess other than the question that I propose, I don't know what other questions you really could ask. And I think that you would, to do that, if that was adopted as the standard, you would run afoul of Rogers and Jackson's warning that you're tainting, you're allowing the judge to taint his or her ability to determine even historical fact.
Counsel, I thought, and I may be wrong, but my recollection of this whole voluntariness stuff was that what is referred to as self-imposed coercion by the defendant generally is not an element to assess involuntariness. Is remorse, would that fall in that category of self-imposed coercion? And maybe my recollection of the black letter is incorrect, but that's my recollection, self-imposed coercion. Because with voluntariness, you're focusing on the actions of the state, and the policy behind that is to curb abuses. And so self-imposed coercion was not an appropriate element to consider when assessing the voluntariness of the statements. Am I right or wrong on that? Number one, on the black letter that I'm asserting that might be black letter, and number two, whether or not remorse would fit into that, indeed it is black letter.
I think that goes more to a situation where a suspect sort of volunteers statements that inculpate him because of reasons that have nothing to do with the police practices. But the problem is in those circumstances where the remorse that causes one to confess is not as a result of an unequal confrontation where pressure is brought on you to overcome your will to resist, then you're right. Then that would ultimately be not a consideration that the confession was involuntary. But the problem is when that remorse is brought out through police coercive tactics, that's, you know, whether it's because you feel remorseful or because you just want to get it over with or because you just will say whatever they want, it doesn't matter if whatever is causing you to resist is overcome by the police coercive tactics, such as a lengthy interrogation or sleep deprivation or things of that nature. I don't know if that answers your question, but
Mr. Booting, could I ask you, when you started your argument, you said that Miranda issues had been waived?
No. Miranda issues were not. We're dealt with at the trial court, and we're not raised on appeal.
Not raised on appeal. Do we have in the record actual Miranda warnings that were administered in document form?
I believe there is I believe there was actually an exhibit.
Well, there's exhibit one that's referred to in the transcript, but that was the second one. Is there a document in the record of an earlier Miranda warning?
Oh, earlier? No, in fact, that's contested. That was contested at the hearing, in that Mr. Agnello claimed he had never been, he was never advised of his Miranda rights until, I believe, the second team of detectives came in. And there was a factual dispute as to whether he had ever been advised of his Miranda rights, number one, and whether he asked for an attorney, in which he said he did, and they said, no, this isn't television, this doesn't work that way, and but also whether there was a lengthy interrogation between 1 a.m. and 6 a.m. A lot of factual disputes were resolved by the courts, and that's the reason, by the way, that this court would have to, I believe, remand for a rehearing before a different judge, because a lot of the factual findings were based on the court's tainted view of the evidence, because she considered truthfulness or falsity in making her evaluation about whether the confession was voluntary. But I want to point out the other reason that I really think the objection was proper, that objection, this isn't relevant for the purposes of this hearing, did not constitute a waiver for a number of reasons, one of which is, you look at the definition of 90401, relevance is any fact which is of consequence to the determination of an action. And Rogers says whether a confession is true or false is not relevant and is not of consequence to the determination of whether confession is voluntary. So under the very definition of relevance, inquiry into the truthfulness or falsity of a confession is not relevant under that definition. In addition, one of the things that I think may be confused by the Court of Appeals and State is that there were really two violations or two errors at that hearing, which have really separate and distinct constitutional basis. One is the Rogers violation by cross-examining the defendant about those things, and that was objected to on the basis of relevance, and that really has its underpinning of due process, not self-incrimination. The court held that it's not because of self-incrimination that we're saying you can't consider that. It's because Rogers says that the due process, the only way to protect due process, to ensure that a defendant has a reliable means of determining whether his confession was involuntary, is to exclude that from the process altogether. And that's what makes it irrelevant, and that's why the relevant objection, I think, preserved that objection. But I will concede that there's a second error that occurred that wasn't preserved by trial counsel, and that is a violation of Mr. Agnello's self-incrimination rights by ordering him to answer questions at the hearing that incriminated himself. Counsel should have objected also on self-incrimination and didn't do that, and I concede that that was waived, but I still, as we argue in the briefs, believe this court should address that issue, because under the plain error rule, substantial rights are being affected there by that violation. But there really are two completely different issues, and I'm not sure that the state, in its brief at least, clarifies that or understood that.
Counsel, it seems to me that there are a couple of waiver issues also. One is the waiver issue that you've been discussing, that is the specificity of the objection raised. Another appears to be whether or not the alleged several tactics of coerciveness have been waived. I look at page 155 of the appendix, setting forth a portion of the transcript, and there the language states, with regard to the objection, I think the totality of the circumstances here also shows that the confession itself was simply coercive circumstances. Yet, as the transcript unfolds, the only specific tactic alleged was the deprivation of sleep. Haven't you waived by not specifically addressing any other alleged tactics that argument?
No, I don't believe so, for a number of reasons. First, and I think the case the state cited, the State versus Caban, I believe is the way you pronounce it, which was decided by this court, I think 2 years ago, is illustrative of when that might be a proper waiver ruling and when it wouldn't. In Caban, The issue was whether or not there was an automobile search was improper, and throughout the hearing at the trial level, defense counsel not only failed to argue lack of probable cause as a ground, but didn't ask any witnesses that, didn't ask any questions of in cross-examination of that, and even objected to the state's efforts to start questioning the witnesses about probable cause. Here we have a situation where it's clear that not only trial counsel questioned witnesses about all of the factors, not just sleep deprivation, but so did the DA. They both elicited evidence going to restraint, length of questioning, relay teams, all of those things throughout the hearing. And when you look at the argument that he just focused on, which was sleep deprivation, it's interrelated to all of those other factors. Lack of sleep was caused in part by the restraint where he couldn't lay down and couldn't get any sufficient rest. It was also caused by the length of the interrogation and the relays of detectives. So all of those were interrelated, and counsel, I think, by pointing out to the court that it's the totality of the circumstances, is telling the court all of these factors impact on the ultimate determination of voluntariness. In addition,
It seems to me that an argument or a response can be that, well, we're talking about waiver of argument, not waiver of evidence, that indeed in the record there may exist evidence regarding the length of questioning, the use of relay teams, or other asserted coercive tactics, that the only tactic that was argued was the sleep deprivation, and thus the only one preserved for appeal.
Well, I think that's too restrictive interpretation of waiver of argument. Otherwise, what you're going to have is you're going to have a hearing. It's all in one day. The court hears all the testimony, and then you're forcing counsel to rehash everything that was just testified to.
But counsel, on that very point, when the judge was making her oral decision from the bench, moments after you raised the totality of circumstances, or whoever was representing him, the judge on at least two separate occasions referred solely to the sleep factor. Now, if that was error, did not the defendant's counsel have a duty to object at that? If you're correct, it seems to me that the judge should have been told by the defendant, Your Honor, we're arguing much more than the sleep factor.
Well, perhaps that would have been the better practice, but again, local rules of decorum usually prevent someone, when a court is making a ruling, interrupting them in the process of their ruling when their mind is made up. Perhaps the better question is, why didn't the state do that? Because
counsel,
the state has the burden of proving that a confession is voluntary.
I am personally not familiar with the local rules of decorum, but I'm not sure, is that in the record, the local rules of decorum?
I don't.
But in any event, I fail to see how a local rule would have prevented counsel at the time Justice Babbage is talking about asserting that argument, that position. If you're telling me that the local rule prevented, then I guess I would accept that. But I fail to understand how any rule of decorum could have prevented the counsel from asserting a position at that particular time mentioned by Justice Babbage.
Well, again, perhaps the better practice would have been for counsel to do that, but I think it imposes too much to require attorneys to always start interrupting a trial court when it's making a hearing. And I think that if that's going to be required, it should be required of the party that has the burden of proof. The state should have directed the court to make findings of facts that, Your Honor, after she was done, Your Honor, I'm asking the court to make additional findings of fact that this wasn't restraint, wasn't coercive, the length of interrogation wasn't coercive, all of the things which the state knew were issues because they were asking questions of their detectives as well. How long did it go? Did you take any breaks? And did you unhandcuff them when you questioned them? They knew that those were issues at the hearing. And since they had the burden of proving that a confession is voluntary, that should have been presented by the state, if anything.
Counsel, when you talk about these rules of decorum, are these the trial court administrative rules?
I guess it's more of a local practice. Milwaukee, being a busy urban court, the trial courts maybe understandably move things along.
Are there written rules?
I'm not sure if there's a specific written rule that says you shall not interrupt the court in the process. Don't.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel. No. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Posner-Weber, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning. May it please the court. State, first and foremost, asks this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals. We ask you to make the following holdings. We ask you, first of all, to hold that the defendant waived his right to raise constitutional error resulting from the prosecutor's cross-examination at the Miranda Goodchild hearing. We ask this court to hold that the defense preserved a single argument in support of the voluntariness claim that police improperly deprived him of sleep. We ask this court to hold that the state was required to prove voluntariness in this matter by a preponderance of the evidence. And finally, we ask this court to hold that the defendant's statement was constitutionally voluntary. All four of those requests.
The fourth one doesn't jive with the first one. The first one is the waive the right to raise the constitutional error, so that only if we say it didn't waive to get to the fourth. Is that correct, or are we talking about...
No, I'm talking about the constitutional error based on the alleged Rogers violation.
Okay, what's your first one? Defendant waived the right to raise constitutional
error. Waived his right to raise the Rogers.
What's your fourth one?
That the statement was constitutionally voluntary. First waiver argument.
Okay.
I'm sorry. First waiver argument refers to his making the Rogers-Jackson argument.
On the third one, and that has to do with the burden of proof.
Right.
It seems that, you know, it seems to me Judge Sykes looked into the bench book, looked at the case, said beyond a reasonable doubt, and applied that standard. And why should, you know, if that's wrong, why shouldn't it be beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, it should be a preponderance of the evidence standard first and foremost, because the United States Supreme Court in Lego versus Toomey says it's a preponderance of the evidence standard. This court in State ex rel Goodchild v. Burke adopted the Jackson versus Deno test for determining voluntariness. Unfortunately, Jackson v. Deno didn't talk about the burden of proof in that case. And this court, at page 264-265 of Goodchild, without any citation to legal authority, said that the burden of proof was beyond a reasonable doubt.
Now, doesn't Lego v. Twomey say it's dealer's choice, that each state can decide for itself what the burden shall be? It can't be less than preponderance, and it can't be more than beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's up to the state.
There's a range, yes. Lego, for purposes of federal constitutional analysis, says the burden is preponderance of the evidence. Wisconsin, historically, has conformed its Fifth and Sixth Amendment jurisprudence, conformed the state constitutional protections for due process to those set by the federal government. And to my knowledge, the defense hasn't argued that the framers of the Wisconsin Constitution intended a higher degree of protection.
Right now, under the Miranda part of the Miranda Goodchild, the burden of proof is on the state.
Yes.
Preponderance.
We believe it's a preponderance, yeah.
So what you want to do is conform it under the Goodchild part of this hearing.
We'd like you to conform it to the Goodchild part of the hearing. We'd like you to conform it to the standard as set in Lego versus Twomey.
And the federal standard.
Under the federal standard.
Are our cases consistent when we talk about the burden of proof and voluntariness?
They have not been in the past, but I've seen, in my view, and as the Court of Appeals indicated in the Agnello decision, there's been an effort by the court to try and bring some consistency to the standards that apply when we're talking about constitutional issues, when we're talking about exclusions of evidence on constitutional grounds. My read on it, and I think the Court of Appeals' read on it, is that this court has attempted to bring some consistency and conformity, because there was loose language in other decisions.
Can I just ask you the same question I asked defense counsel here? There is something that's appealing by the concurrence, that you can explain the confession other than guilt and other than using the confession against the person by saying, well, it's true. What kind of line of questioning would you, if the court adopted that, and I don't know that you are asking the court, are you asking the court to adopt the concurrence?
I'm asking the court to adopt the concurrence insofar as Judge Fine has suggested a line of questioning that involves truthfulness under a very limited set of circumstances. And the limited set of circumstances is the suggestion that we have here, as Justice Crooks indicated. We had affirmative evidence in the record that suggested that this man confessed because he was remorseful.
Where is that?
In my brief at page 12, Chief
right.
Justice. The language of Detective Temp at the top of page 12. My position, and I believe Judge Fine's position, would be that the testimony regarding his emotional release, his Agnello's emotional release when he was making his confession, was indicative of remorse. Before I forget, also, Justice Bradley asked if it was in fact black letter law that remorse is not a...
Internal coercion.
Internal coercion, thank you. The case I think you would want to look at is Crummel, C-R-U-M-M-E-L, versus State, which is at 46 Wis 2nd, 348. The pinpoint citation is 353. The specific quote is, "It is not a function of police authorities to protect a perpetrator of crimes against the promptings of his own conscience." There's language also to that effect in a Seventh Circuit decision called United States against Westbrook, which is located at 125, Fed Third, 996. The pinpoint citation is 1005 to 1006. The language of the quote is, "The police are allowed to play on a suspect's ignorance, anxieties, fears, and uncertainties. They are just not allowed to magnify those fears, uncertainties, and so forth to the point where rational decision becomes impossible."
I can see
the
that.
State language, though, is in Crummel.
I can understand that, but what kind of questions can you ask the defendant himself when he takes the stand to show remorse? I mean, I can understand a detective testifying, crying, he had to have a guilty conscience, indicated burdens, etc. But what can you ask the defendant? I mean, that's what this case is about, isn't it? Not the detective's testimony. No one's objecting to that.
Sure.
They're objecting to the questions to the defendant.
I think the prosecutor, first of all, could have done what he did here.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I think the prosecutor could have done what he did here. I believe we've made the argument that's necessary to uphold the concurrences analysis. I think the prosecutor also could have asked the defendant, "Your position here is that you confessed, you made this statement because you were coerced, isn't that correct?" "Yes." "You felt some release when you made your confession, didn't you?" "Yes." "You heard Detective Temp testify that you cried, didn't you?" "Didn't you?" "Yes." "You felt bad about what happened to this man, didn't you?" "Yes." "He was your foster father, wasn't he?" "Yes." I think the prosecutor could have developed a line of analysis within the confines of Rogers and Jackson to establish that the reason that the defendant confessed was not because he was coerced, but because he felt bad.
I think those are good questions, but none of them are in this record.
None of them were asked, and we do not know, unfortunately, we do not know the subjective mindset of the prosecutor in asking the line of questions that point to for the concurrence, and I will admit that.
The prosecutor wasn't stopped here by the judge. I mean, he just changed the line when he wanted to.
No, it's a relatively brief cross-examination. It's reproduced in its entirety in the appendix to the state's brief.
It's in the footnote.
And it's also a line of questioning up to the objection, I think, is in a footnote in the decision. I'd like to come back.
Counsel, could I ask you, is there any other document in the record about Miranda warnings? Exhibit 1 is referred to, but is there some other exhibit of an earlier Miranda warning?
No, Justice Prosser, I don't believe there is. Counsel thought that there might have been an exhibit in the record that contained the actual written Miranda warnings. I don't have the trial exhibits in front of me. I only have the record documents. I would direct your attention to Record 25 at page 170. Record 25 at 170 is at page 136 of our appendix. Lines 8 through 18 are the trial court's findings of fact regarding Mr. Agnello's being advised of his Miranda warnings. As I understand it, the defense in this case has never suggested that those findings are against the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence. The Miranda issue in this case, as I recall, was a claimed Edwards violation, and it wasn't pursued on appeal. I'd like to come back to Justice Crooks's and Justice Wilcox's point toward the close of counsel's argument, because I think they're important. To my knowledge, the local rules of decorum for Milwaukee are not reduced to writing and are certainly not a part of the record in this case. I have no doubt that certain practices arise, that judicial preferences are honored by attorneys whenever possible, but to suggest, first of all, that a local rule of decorum is relevant in this case can't be substantiated in the record. Second of all, I very much doubt that a local rule of decorum could trump a decision of this court or a rule of evidence or any other United States Supreme Court pronouncement on an issue in controversy. And the appellate courts in this state have uniformly said that you have to be specific in an objection in order to preserve an issue for appellate review. Counsel for Mr. Agnello made an acknowledgement during his argument that I guess I misunderstood, and maybe he can come back to it in rebuttal, but he told this court that he perceived not only a due process objection in this case, but also a possible objection based on self-incrimination grounds. And then counsel tells us that the self-incrimination objection is waived. The words self-incrimination or due process don't appear anywhere in trial counsel's objections. Never made a self-incrimination objection, never made a due process objection. I don't understand why the one would be waived and the other not be. Unless it's counsel's position, and I don't understand Mr. Agnello to be making this argument, but if it's his position that any time a trial attorney objects on grounds of relevance that automatically preserves a due process claim, then this court needs to disabuse attorneys of that notion in this decision. You do not make specific constitutional objections simply by making a one-word objection relevance.
Well, that's right, counsel, and if you allow relevance, it can cover everything. But as I understand the bench book, it does use the word relevance here, doesn't it?
It does.
It says that this evidence is not relevant.
It does, and it cites Rogers.
So the question to my mind then is, well, when you have an issue of what value is, the bench book is very valuable, but to what extent you can use it at an appellate level. And two, if the bench book uses the word relevance, isn't that good enough? And maybe the answer is yes, or maybe the answer is no, because you have to follow it up with a statement of what the relevance issue is.
It's not good enough if the trial judge isn't told to look at the bench book, or isn't asked to check the bench book. If the only objection is relevance, we wouldn't be here on this issue if the defense attorney had said, objection, relevance, Rogers versus Richmond Jackson against Denham. We wouldn't be here on this issue. If the defense attorney had said, objection, relevance, truthfulness is not a proper determination when you're considering voluntariness, we probably wouldn't be here, unless the prosecutor articulated his theory of relevance consistent with Judge Fine's analysis. That didn't happen. A proper objection has four components. It has to be in the form of an objection. It has to be on the record. It has to be timely. And it has to reasonably advise the circuit court of the grounds upon which it is based.
Well, isn't Rogers a relevancy case?
Rogers is a relevancy case, but as the chief pointed out, relevancy... I'm sorry.
No, keep going.
As the Chief pointed out, relevancy can have a number of different facets. Evidence can be irrelevant because it's speculative. Was this an objection based on the speculative nature of the testimony? No, it was a precise constitutional objection that we only found out about when counsel filed his brief in the Court of Appeals. If the trial attorney in this case had led the circuit court, Judge Sykes, and the prosecutor to the cases that he deemed dispositive, we could have unrung the bell in this case. We really could have.
But you would not hold an objector to citing authority, would you?
Not under all circumstances, no. The case law says if you can determine the basis of the objection from the context of the circumstances, no, you don't have to cite case authority. That's not possible here, because the objection was so vague.
But Rod, I get back to my the problem is that the Rogers case says it's not relevant. The truthfulness or falsity of the statement is not relevant. What would be a proper objection, counsel, then?
Under these circumstances?
Yeah.
Objection, Your Honor, Rogers versus Richmond.
Oh, so you would require him to cite authority?
Under this set of circumstances, yes. And the Court of Appeals, in its decision, I think says it better than I can. It's at page 7 of the slip opinion, which is also in the appendix to the brief. I'm quoting from the slip here, page 7. Without reference to the statements made by the Supreme Court in Rogers and Jackson, and without any other explanation or argument by the defendant's counsel, evidence concerning the truthfulness of a defendant's confession might reasonably seem relevant to a trial court attempting to appraise the credibility of a testifying witness. This is a decision written by three former trial judges.
What? Right, and maybe we shouldn't let him off the hook so easily. Because couldn't any objection then be discarded on those grounds if the trial judge doesn't know the authority?
No, and we've talked about this because plainly this is also a situation where the state could find itself on the short end of an objection. Under the circumstances of a case, sometimes it is so obvious from the basis, from what's going on, that we know what the basis for the objection is. If I'm cross-examining a defendant on an other act, isn't it a fact, sir, that 5 years before the charged crime, you molested a little girl? And the objection comes up, objection, relevance, or objection, other acts, or objection, 90404. Under those circumstances, or 90403, under those circumstances, there's no question what the basis for the objection would be. Here, it was vague. It was so vague that everybody's left to guess. And Judge Sykes, bless her, thought that this was relevant to the question of credibility. And the defense didn't do anything to disabuse her of that notion. And if it was, the defense didn't do anything to disabuse her of the notion. And if they had, this was a bell that could have been unrung. Because the prosecutor could have come in and said, Judge, we've taken a recess. I've read Rogers v. Richmond. This is a problematic area. So I'm going to drop my line of questioning, and Judge, I'm also going to ask you, when you make your voluntariness determination, to specifically not consider the truthfulness of the statement. Rogers v. Richmond doesn't say, first of all, Rogers v. Richmond doesn't say that it's impossible for a trial judge to put aside questions of truthfulness in deciding voluntariness. I don't think it does.
Okay.
More to the point, we've cited cases to you in the state's brief where other reviewing courts, admittedly from other jurisdictions, but other reviewing courts have considered claims of error similar to the defense's and have found that since the trial judge didn't explicitly rely on the truthfulness of the statement in making a voluntariness determination.
Where is the line drawn? I mean, I recognize what you're saying, that we certainly don't want to allow defense counsels to simply lay traps for trial judges who may not have the name of a case or the substance of a case at the tip of their tongue. But on the other hand, where are we going to... that seems like such a vague, ambiguous line that you're drawing, that sometimes they have to give authority and sometimes they don't. I mean, if I was trying this case, the greatest trial lawyer in the world might not have known of the existence of Rogers when they went in.
greatest trial judge either, Justice Babich, and that's the problem. That's the problem. The greatest trial judge in the world, counsel talks about a high-volume courtroom in Milwaukee County, certainly is high-volume. Hyams v. Henke, this court's own decision says we don't expect trial judges to hold all of the principles of law in their heads at any given time. So we oblige parties that are asking for a boon from the trial court, that are asking to admit or exclude evidence, to be specific enough to let the judge know what the basis is.
Okay, but certainly there's no claim here that the defendant intentionally sandbagged the judge.
No. Nothing to indicate that he was intentionally trying to sandbag the judge. Also, no claim that counsel was ineffective.
Intentionally sandbag the judge, and he did raise, at least arguably, the first prong of, incorrectly, the first prong of an objection, i.e. relevancy, you say he should have gone on, but at least he was correct in saying relevancy. And if the trial judge is unaware of the appropriate relevancy argument, the defendant loses.
If the circumstances are such that the true, i.e. what the defense believes the basis for the objection is, if the true basis for the objection isn't disclosed to the trial court, then yeah, the trial court will probably enter an incorrect decision.
Even if under these circumstances, Judge Sykes then went on to consider, incorrectly, obviously, under Rogers, the truthfulness or credibility of the decision, because she didn't think there was any problem. She was unaware of Rogers. Nevertheless, the defendant would lose because you would have us hold that he waived it.
Under these circumstances, yes. He was obliged to make a better objection than he did. As it turns out, the trial judge did not expressly rely on the truthfulness, and you're sitting back, and that's dangerous for me.
I'm thinking.
it's an awkward situation, and it's an unfortunate situation. And waiver rules often work unfortunate consequences, not only for the defense, but also for the state. You know, we end up losing on waiver as well, not as often as the defense, because we're normally the respondent in these cases. But there are times when waiver rules cut against the state. But we have good, solid policy considerations that support the application of waiver rules. Like, we would not be here now, or we would only be here for part of the appeal if the defendant in this case, if defense counsel in this case, had made the appropriate objection, or a more detailed objection.
Suppose the defense counsel here had made the objection and cited Rogers, then what does the court do?
If the court's not familiar with the case, the court says, I need a little more counsel. Why is Rogers relevant? Give me the holding of Rogers. In an extreme situation, the court might take a recess for 5 or 10 minutes, look at the decision, come out and say, well, what about it, Mr. Williams? As Mark Williams was the prosecutor in this. What about it, state? Counsel's given me a case that suggests this line of questioning is inappropriate. Do you have a response? And maybe he would have, and maybe he would not have. I don't know. The defense didn't give us an opportunity to do that here.
Counsel, I want to move back to the burden of proof. You discussed earlier, and you made a disparaging comment, I say that tongue-in-cheek, with regard to Goodchild, saying, and it cited without citation the proposition that the burden is beyond a reasonable doubt. And you advanced that the better way is to go to the Lego case, the U.S. Supreme Court case. But as I look at other cases in this state, I think the Blaschke case in 75, the Mitchell case in 1992, this court has specifically stated, and sometimes with citation, that the burden for the state is beyond a reasonable doubt on the issue of voluntariness. What Wisconsin case can you cite where we said that it was preponderance of evidence on the issue of voluntariness?
We've looked primarily at Court of Appeals decisions, specifically Albrecht, and I'm thinking Santiago. And I don't believe Santiago was. I think Santiago was a decision of this court, but it was not a voluntariness issue.
How do you address the Mitchell case, the 1992 case, where we specifically said Yes, it was a Supreme Court case that said, I have on page 696, that the defendant's statement were voluntary. The state has the burden to establish these facts beyond a reasonable doubt, citing Hernandez, which I haven't read. 61 was second at 258 for that proposition. And right before that discussion, there's the citation to the Goodchild case also. So we've got, it looks to me, several Wisconsin cases that have stated that the burden of proof for the state is beyond a reasonable doubt on the issue of voluntariness.
But in none of those cases, well, I prefer to go back to Goodchild. And I read Goodchild as an effort by this court to adopt the test in Jackson v. Denham, to adopt the orthodox determination of voluntariness, that particular test. And I think what was happening was that this court in Goodchild was attempting to discern from the case law, the federal case law, just what the federal courts believed the standard of proof to be.
But what do you do with Goodchild's 65 case? What do you do with the Blaschke case in, I think, 75, the Mitchell case in 92, the Wallace case in 73? They all continue to cite Goodchild for the proposition that the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt.
I had a long talk with one of our senior lawyers in the office on this, Mr. Ballastieri. Mr. Ballastieri tells me, and I have no reason to doubt him, that long before I became a lawyer, the state has never taken the opportunity in the voluntariness cases that have come before this court to specifically argue for the adoption of the Lego versus Tomey standard, that either the burden of proof was not an issue in controversy in the case, or that the state did not ask this court to adopt the preponderance of the evidence standard. I'm asking you to do that now, and making Mr. Ballastieri happy in the process.
And to withdraw the language of the several cases that I've cited that overtly state what the burden is, that is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Absolutely, and the reason is I have not seen, either in the defendant's pleadings and briefing, or in any other source or reference, any indication that the framers of the Wisconsin Constitution intended the scope of due process protection, self-incrimination protection, whatever standard you wish to invoke here. I've never seen any indication that the framers intended the Wisconsin Constitution to provide a greater scope of protection. This court, in a long line of cases, in the Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment context, have said two things. One, we conform Wisconsin constitutional law to federal constitutional law. Two, until somebody gives us a reason to do it otherwise, until someone briefs persuasively an indication that the framers of the Wisconsin Constitution intended the state constitution to provide a greater degree of protection. Now, I understand that has been a contentious issue on this court. State versus Seibel, a Fourth Amendment case from way back where Justice Bablich and Justice Cece engaged in dialogue involving whether the Wisconsin Constitution should be construed to provide a greater degree of protection. I don't take any position on that issue here. All I'm saying is there's nothing, no reason to believe that the Wisconsin Constitution provides a greater degree of protection in this regard.
Mr. Posner-Weber
hasn't given us a reason to believe.
Mr. Posner-Weber, let me ask you about the Albrecht case. That was a published decision by the Court of Appeals. Was there a petition for review that was denied by this court?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
All right.
I don't know. I can find that out and communicate it to the court this afternoon if you like.
I would like that.
Assuming we don't find waiver, I'd like to move very quickly to the questions that were asked and which were responded to. And I understand they were simply just a couple of questions, is that correct? Asking that went directly to Mr. Agnello, is the statement true? Or can you enlighten me a little bit more on the actual questioning?
There was at the beginning, at the front end of the questioning, an exchange where the prosecutor, I want to give you the exact. There was a question at the beginning of the cross-examination. It's at page 129 of my appendix, lines 15 to 20. And you wrote down, quote, this is true, and you signed it, is that right? Answer, yes, I was told to. Question, and you did that because what is in the statement is true, is that correct? Answer, no, because I was extremely tired and scared. That was the first exchange. No objection at that point, too, I might add.
Now, isn't it, are there other questions that you want to point out to us, or is that about?
Well, the objection came at page 130 of the appendix,
okay.
Lines 17 to 22. There was also an inquiry at page 132 and at the top of 133 where the prosecutor is saying, you remember what Mr. Olson read to you, yeah, with the basic, and that was basically true. Is that correct? Answer, I wouldn't go as far as basically true, no. The bulk of the questioning was actually over the specifics of the statement.
Well, let me tell you what my thinking is so that you can respond if I may, Chief.
Red light, good.
We were in the course of this dialogue when the red light went on. My thinking is that under Rogers, it seems that the question, is it true, were you telling the truth, etc., is simply verboten territory. You can come up to it, if possibly, arguably, on the question of remorse, etc. But when you get right down to the basic stuff of whether this is true or not, it seems to me that Rogers, on its face anyway, seems to say you can't do it because it might influence your thinking, Judge.
I read Rogers as saying that the Supreme Court does have concerns about questions regarding the truthfulness, because what we want to do in excluding these particular statements is discourage improper police conduct. I don't read Rogers as creating a blanket exception in situations like this one and in the circumstances posited by Judge Fine, where you have a defendant who arguably confessed because of remorse and is now coming in and saying, I really confessed because the officer squeezed my hands and because I was tired. I don't read Rogers as excluding that possibility. And I'm deep in the red. Thank
good.
You.
And you'd like to sit down. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Beauty.
Thank you. Dealing first with the burden of proof issue, what counsel ignores is that Nego says the states are free to adopt greater protections for their own citizens. Counsel assumes that the only way that can be done is if their state constitution gives them that greater protection. But in fact, State versus Doe and State versus Hansford, recently decided, just in June, I believe, talks about how long-standing practice in the state, be it case law, statutes, or constitutional basis, do justify giving credit to a practice that is greater protection than the state, than the federal.
But counsel, can you win on this issue? I mean, it's nice to clarify the law, but what standard did the trial court apply?
I'm sorry?
What standard did the trial, a burden of proof did this trial court?
The trial court applied beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, all right.
But the reason we can't credit that is because the trial court's findings included, in applying that, included the credibility of the defendant, which were tainted by the Rogers violation.
But that would have been true even if the trial court had applied preponderance of the evidence. That's your position regardless of what the trial court's burden is. So the only purpose there would be to clarify the law. You can't win on that issue.
Right. Yeah, the issue would be to clarify the law and what the correct burden is, but it should still be remanded because of the court's findings intertwined with the Rogers violation. And here, I cite on page 55 of my brief a long, long, long line of cases where this court has, and the Court of Appeals, in fact, has repeatedly said the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. Goodchild didn't just pull this out of thin air. We have probably over 100 years of long-standing practice in this state where that's the burden. Before Goodchild, it was I think, because the juries were ultimately, if there was an uncertainty on whether it was voluntary or not, juries had to apply the determination of whether it's voluntary, and they had the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The states offered no good reason why we should now overturn. What this court would have to do is overrule Goodchild and all the cases that follow it on that point. And I suggest that there are some very good reasons why we should have a different standard. Miranda is a prophylactic rule. That's all it is. It doesn't really have any substantive basis other than preventing police abuse. Whereas, even though at the hearing itself, Rogers says truthfulness and the reliability of the confession itself isn't to be considered, many cases in Wisconsin and elsewhere, even since then, talk about how one of the concerns is If police are coercing people to confess, then innocent people may be wrongly convicted because the confession itself might not be reliable. And that's been a long-standing goal, that the policy of this state, that we, if necessary, let guilty people go free on occasion in order to protect the innocent from being wrongly convicted. And I suggest that that alone is justification for this court continuing its long-standing beyond a reasonable doubt standard. Quickly, going back to the question of why relevance, objection relevance, isn't enough. I really think State versus Marx, which I cite in the brief, and which the state's completely ignored and the Court of Appeals ignored, really answers this question. State versus Marx says, we will not elevate form over substance on a waiver issue. And in that case, they ultimately held that the objection based on the confrontation encompassed an objection also based on the trial court's finding of unavailability. There was a co-defendant who testified at a preliminary hearing, then subsequently refused at the trial to testify under the Fifth. The trial court allowed his preliminary hearing testimony against the defendant. The defendant objected under confrontation grounds, and then on appeal also argued that the trial court's unavailability finding was incorrect, and the state argued they'd waived that latter part. And this court, in State versus Marks, which I believe was 1995, said we're not going to elevate form over substance here. The objection was specific enough to apprise the parties of what the concerns were, and that it encompassed both a confrontation objection encompassed both confrontation and unavailability determination. Here, Rogers says it's not relevant. And it's not relevant because of due process grounds, not self-incrimination. And on that basis, I submit that it is properly encompassed. The objection based on relevance encompasses the Rogers argument, because that's all it was based on, is relevance. The state argues that if you wait...